effective open standard for authentication. And there's a company called YubiKey. So it's like Yubi company, YubiKey. And you guys have probably heard me talking about YubiKeys ever since 2014. If you need to utilize a software package for password management, I do strongly recommend Bruce Schneier's tool called PasswordSafe in concert with a YubiKey. And there is extensive documentation on QualityPlusConsulting.com website on exactly how to set this up and how to use it. It's a really great guide. I spent a bunch of time building that, and I hope you find it useful. So password management is so important that we utilize really high-quality password management techniques, and I am really not a fan of these online cloud-based password manager applications such as LastPass. And first off, LastPass has actually been compromised. And now they would argue it wasn't really a massive breach, but I would argue that really anytime you have a big pile of attractive candy, such as a centralized database storing everybody's passwords, that puts a big target on that. And unfortunately, access to LastPass has not ever been by something that was what would be characterized as FIDO U2F compliant. And there's a big gap between the SMS-based authentication or an OTP one-time passcode authentication versus something that's literally a token that generates an absolutely unique code with every activation. So this is why this whole element of the FIDO U2F standard now achieving what's called AAL3, which is the authentication assurance level 3. And this has now been achieved with NIST. So this open standard called FIDO U2F, which is really what the YubiKey does, it has achieved this highest level of authentication assurance with the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. This is a really big deal. And I find it kind of interesting that it's taken this long. I was using YubiKeys extensively starting in 2014. And when I mean extensively, I'm basically meaning with as much as I could possibly use it with that it would be compatible with. And anytime you have something like that, that is, it's a new tool, it has to be adopted by the technology people. And then they work together to create standards. And then they push out these things as open source and say, okay, well, these particular software developers writing these new systems, well, you can include this enhanced functionality in your offering if you'd like to, and here's how you do it. And so what you see are modules for a lot of websites now that are compatible with YubiKeys. So let's just do a recap here on authentication, multi-factor authentication, so that you can understand why a token-based system is superior to all others. So if we look at SSA.gov, what they're doing is they have username, password, and then they send you an SMS text message. And that's not mandatory, right? It's only if you want enhanced multi-factor authentication. Now, the problem with the text messaging stuff is that certainly, if you're in the basement of a steel and concrete building and your cell phone doesn't get connection there, well, that obviously is not going to work. And it's also been proven that SMS text messaging can be intercepted and faked. There is another enormous, and I mean enormous, vulnerability associated with this. And this is recently played out in this whole topic of literally virtually everyone who has ever posted on social media that they have cryptocurrency. Those people have been targeted. Their personal cell phone numbers have been obtained. And then large-scale brute force attempts have been made, and very successfully, to make all these phone calls to the various cell phone providers and to get a service representative at the cell phone provider company to change the IMEI that that phone number is associated with. So what has become very boldly known is that virtually everyone who has ever posted on social media as having cryptocurrency has now had their personal cell phone number stolen. And when I say stolen, the bad guys have basically figured out that this SMS text-based multi-factor authentication, this validation process, is the way in order to obtain access, like, for example, a password reset, to that person's cryptocurrency account. So all they have to do in order to breach this weakness in this SMS-based authentication mechanism for multi-factor authentication is to keep calling Verizon or keep calling AT&T or Sprint until they get a gullible representative who's willing to listen to their sob story and then transfer that phone number to an IMEI, which is basically a SIM card, under the control of the hacker. And so now then the hacker goes and does a password reset, and they now have the multi-factor authentication component. So you see, this is a major security problem with SMS-based validation processes. Now, as I've stated before, I think that having any level of multi-factor authentication is better than not having multi-factor authentication. I mean, there's literally not a month that goes by now that there is not somebody that I personally know who has been compromised because they weren't using multi-factor authentication. I mean, it's like every month now, and this is just the people that I know. So imagine how much is happening to everybody else. So clearly, multi-factor authentication is actually pretty darned effective in terms of keeping the bad guy out of your stuff. However, there are different levels of effectiveness of multi-factor authentication out there. And the idea that you have a separate token, such as the YubiKey, that you maintain physical control over, and that this device cannot be remotely activated even if your computer was being remote controlled, then that means that even if the bad guys are able to steal your password file, and they're able to keystroke log, steal the decryption password, if you had that password file also with a multi-factor authentication mechanism based upon the token-based physical presence YubiKey, then they're basically not going to get into it. Because even if they use something like Hashcat, let's say they didn't know the password and they just decided to brute force it with Hashcat, because that's actually possible. Again, they're missing the token. So they're not getting into that thing. Now, you know, maybe the people at the NSA are so darn smart that they can get into it. And, you know, maybe the people that have these biological, heavy-duty, DNA-based capable computing systems now that have so much computing power that they can just crack anything, maybe they can get it. But that's a pretty small number of individuals that have access to such things. And I would argue that there's very little that you're ever going to be able to do to keep the state actors out of your stuff. And what I mean by a state actor is, you know, we're talking the big five, the Five Eyes, you know, the government of China, right? You know, government of the United States, the NSA, these sorts of things. Because what they've done is they've effectively backtapped everything. And so trying to keep their prying eyes from your stuff when they've backtapped everything is a very tall order to have. So I'm not even going to really go down that road. Nonetheless, the primary thing that we're all interested in doing is keeping criminals out of our stuff. And so it's a really big thing now that the YubiKey with the FIDO UTF standard has achieved this this AAL3 level, so the highest level of authentication assurance. And this, I think, bodes well to being able to have more effective multi-factor authentication easily available everywhere. And, you know, I'm really reminded by the fact that in the year 2000, there were Central American banks that had online access that were using tokens. I mean, they had real multi-factor authentication going on. And still to this day, in the bulk of the United States, most people's bank accounts are still not protected with multi-factor authentication. And if they have any level of multi-factor authentication going on, it's a weak mechanism. And that weak mechanism is text messaging or something like, oh, let me show you your special security phrase and this and the security image. And the reason I say all those things are weak is because the bad guys can remotely compromise those multi-factor authentication mechanisms. So a physical token that you maintain physical presence over that cannot be remotely initiated or remotely triggered is the only thing that's basically demonstrating human physical presence. And this is the key element truly in authentication assurance, that it's the real intended human present doing that action. So again, any level of multi-factor authentication is better than none, but this is a big step forward. So I'm going to move on to the next topic of Deloitte was compromised, and it was pretty spectacular, actually. I do strongly suggest you go pull the article that I've posted for this show. And that article shows a very extensive pattern of egregiously just beyond all levels of stupidity. Things being publicly internet accessible that never should have, even in the smallest of tiny, tiny, tiny businesses, would never have been publicly accessible. But yet Deloitte doesn't even have effective security controls and internal personnel controls to the degree that they're able to stop these things from happening in their organization, and they purport themselves to be the top cybersecurity vendor internationally. Well, this is clearly some massive piles of egg on their face. And if you do a little internet searching, you find that a lot of cybersecurity experts around the world really have no respect for Deloitte at all. And they've been very disgruntled with Deloitte's lack of quality of their product, and that it appears that what Deloitte has been interested in over a long time pattern, and again, these are the opinions of these cybersecurity experts that I read their postings, where they were effectively saying, look, what we see is a pattern where Deloitte is just interested in getting the job, so they low bid, and then they do, you know, bare minimum, and they're not really doing effective or comprehensive enough cybersecurity audits, analysis, and services. And this is now evidenced, it's kind of come to fruition in another venue, in that Deloitte themselves have been breached. And to quote an article from The Register, which is linked with this show, says, just in the last day, I found 7,000 to 12,000 hosts open for Deloitte spread across the globe. And this was security researcher Dan Tentler, the founder of Phobos Group. So 7,000 to 12,000 open hosts. Wow. I mean, wow. And, you know, you really have to look at that and say, okay, Who in their right mind would continue to hire Deloitte after this incident? This was not just a few hosts. This wasn't some sort of like, well, we had a few employees who did not adhere to our internal training standards and our internal controls, and our internal audit department just didn't find it. Okay. This was not isolated. When you're talking about 7,000 to 12,000 open hosts, that's into the holy cats category. That's the type of stuff that tells you that there is an internal pattern inside that business that has allowed that to be the outcome. And so my viewpoint is, I can't imagine why anyone in their right mind would want to continue to do business with them. And if Deloitte cannot, if they're supposed to be a cybersecurity firm and they cannot even protect their own assets, then why would you even want them to do anything associated with your accounting services either? And I think this opens up a whole nother interesting, you know, perspective, which is that there's a lot of us out there that would prefer to just always do business with small to medium business, where those organizations are either still run by the founders or some of the founders' family still involved. Ultimately, it's people who are, they understand whatever their business is and their industry, and they're not just churning, they're not just like financial managers interested in managing the stock price, which is what you get when you are dealing with an enormous behemoth bureaucracy that has no agility left, such as Deloitte. So a lot of people that I talk to would prefer to do business with small to medium business. You know, they want the business to be large enough and in business long enough to the point where it seems like it's a stable, viable business. But it's really kind of like investing, in that you want to know you're investing in a company that has good quality leadership and management who's really going to be responsive to the client needs, the customer needs, and who's going to care a lot about protecting the assets of that company as well as the client's assets. And you just tend to see too much divergence of what's in the customer's best interest versus these people who are managing these large bureaucratic organizations whose day in and day out job is really stock price management, which is what you get when you're dealing with a lot of these large publicly traded companies, is, you know, the people running them are primarily interested in stock price management because they're reporting to a board of directors who says that that's what's important. And all of their financial incentives are based upon the financial performance of the company. So low bidding jobs, getting more jobs at a low bid and squeaking by with whatever it is that they have to do to squeak by, is oftentimes more important. And I see this in the small to medium business space as well. But where I don't see it, it never seems to be happening in the case. And what I mean by it never seems to be happening, I don't see the drive or the adherence to quality suffering when the executive management of that company is really deeply involved in the day-to-day operations of that organization and their engineers. You know, I mean, I can tell you about some exceptions to that where I've seen, and I talked about this on the last show, the largest home remodeler in the state of Wisconsin, the two owners, the two founders of that company spend $150,000 a year on marketing and couldn't give one rat's fur, you know, one little tiny fur on the back of a rat. They don't even care that much about their cybersecurity. And as a result, their stuff has been in a constant state of hack and breach for at least the last several years that I'm aware of. And they don't want to spend any money to fix it when it really doesn't cost that much to fix it. So that's kind of the rarity, I would say. So there's problems with dealing with these enormous behemoth companies. You don't have security in dealing with them. in my experience. All right, moving on to the whole stingray update. This was really interesting because stingrays have been unconstitutionally utilized in an almost ubiquitous fashion across the entire United States for at least the last 10 to 15 years. And stingrays are devices that have been utilized by almost every shape, size, and flavor of law enforcement agency out there across the entire country for the illegal bulk capture and bulk interception without a warrant of all cell phone users in a particular area. Now, unfortunately, there's only one cell phone that I'm aware of that's manufactured anywhere in the entire world that even has the capability to detect the fact that it was getting hijacked by a stingray. And that happens to be a $3,000 cell phone that is designed for security executives and it's manufactured in Germany. So that is effectively unobtainium to a lot of people. Although I might argue that I think maybe that's changing, because if you look at a lot of people now, they're spending $1,000 on $900 and some on an iPhone, and they're doing that every 2 years. So if you can get a very high quality, high security cell phone, and that thing is designed to last 3 to 5 years, well, you're probably actually going to end up spending less money and getting more value for this super high end encrypted cell phone. So even the black phone does not have the ability to detect that it has been connected to a stingray and hijacked. So these stingrays have been unconstitutionally used, and finally a District of Columbia court ruled recently that tracking phones without a warrant is unconstitutional. Oh wow, shock. I mean, we all knew that this was unconstitutional. It was a Fourth Amendment violation, but yet it's been going on for 10 to 15 years, at least. So I've posted a really interesting article for you to read about that, because I'm not terribly hopeful that the tide is turning. I just think that law enforcement agencies will find a new way to get away with these constitutional violations of our Fourth Amendment rights, but at least maybe one court is doing something about it. Okay, the next topic was talking about the change in the Outlook client associated with Office 365 users. Now, Office 365 is extensively used, especially in business. The world is kind of moving to three different types of email services. You've got businesses that seem to be in love with Gmail for whatever reason, and then businesses use Office 365. And then the third category are primarily your either the holdovers, the people that are still on their old technology, or people that are more privacy-centered. So I hope everybody realizes that if you're using Gmail, that is absolutely back-channeled through the CIA. You know, Google is one of the biggest providers of services to the CIA. And they don't give you Gmail for free for nothing, right? So you have to understand that all of your emails are being, you know, bulk captured and back-channeled by multiple federal agencies. So privacy is not a component of Gmail. And you can certainly make the same argument with Office 365. So if you are a user of either of those services, you have to acknowledge the fact that you're effectively providing the NSA and the federal government on all of their alphabet soup agencies direct access to everything that you have stored in there. So that is clearly not a good fit for a lot of individuals that have a desire to not just willingly hand it over, but maybe make it a little more difficult for the federal agencies to have access to that data, because it's not just them. It's then the Five Eyes, right? It's all of this information sharing that goes on between all the state actors. Okay, so that's the whole privacy aspect to it. Now, there is now this change that's happening in the way that the Outlook client is connecting to Office 365. So first, if you don't use Office 365, this really is not going to affect you. But if you're an Office 365 user and you have an old version of Office on your computer, so basically if you have anything other than Office 2016, you will likely start to experience some issues with connectivity to Exchange Online as of October 31st, 2017. And there is definitely no longer any support for connectivity with Outlook 2007. So that's a big no-no. Depending upon how you have Outlook 2010 patched, it might still connect, but I really don't recommend it. There's too many issues with Outlook 2010. I would suggest just get off of it. And if you're going to upgrade, you should just be upgrading to Office 2016 and just be done with it. So there are these issues with using RPC over HTTP, limitations, not really supporting multi-factor authentication, just a lot of reasons why Microsoft is deprecating that support for that RPC over HTTP connection. And I think it's a great idea. It's been pretty long in the tooth coming. And so it's important that everybody go look at their Office version on their computer if they're connecting to Office 365 or they're planning on doing it soon. I would say make sure that you are proactive about this and get your Office, locally installed Office version updated to Office 2016 prior to then. Wrapping up the show, two topics are the anti-ransomware free tools being provided by Trend Micro right now. I provide a link to those you should check out. One is a machine learning assessment tool. Another is an anti-threat toolkit that scans your machine for malware. And the WannaCry simple patch validation tool, so you can download that and verify that your computer is patched so that it doesn't have the WannaCry vulnerability anymore. Of course, you should still remove SMB1 CIFS capabilities. Next is this topic of the CryptoMator, which is cryptomator.org. It's an interesting little website that is providing a free client-side encryption tool for all of your cloud files. And for those of you who are utilizing something like Dropbox or really anything where you don't have full control over the backend or the cloud storage, where this would be different if, let's say, you had Azure file shares where you did what's called bring your own key. That's a completely different animal. But that's not going to be 99% of everybody out there. So 99% of everybody out there could benefit from CryptoMator, where you are able to encrypt your files before they get sent to the cloud storage. This is a big deal because there was a tool many years ago called TrueCrypt that just support for TrueCrypt failed and TrueCrypt wasn't supported anymore, so it stopped really working. And it seems that this tool, CryptoMator, is a great replacement for TrueCrypt. So for everybody out there that used to use TrueCrypt, you should check out CryptoMator.org.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, a program titled The Changing of Work, Entrepreneurship is the New Normal will take place Wednesday, November 8th at Keenall Manufacturing. Keenall is located on 102nd Ave and 55th Street. Dial 818-1414.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. Visit jackandrea.com.